Mr. Colson, you told Senator Weicker last week that you were proud to be serving the president, and you used the present tense, and there have been a number of reports that you are in continued contact with Mr. Nixon. How recently have you had any contact with the president, directly or indirectly?
Well, not for several weeks, not for quite some time, but let me say that the proudest moments of my life were serving this president, who I think will go down in history as one of the greatest presidents of all time. And I'm not going to comment on my conversations with Senator Weicker, but if the statement has been made that I'm proud to have served this president, that's absolutely correct.
From CBS News, Washington, Face the Nation on the CBS Radio Network. A spontaneous and unrehearsed news interview with Charles Colson, former special counsel to the president. Mr. Colson will be questioned by CBS News correspondent Daniel Shore, Robert Novak, syndicated columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times, and by CBS News correspondent George Herman. We shall continue our interview in a moment.
Don't let anyone con you into thinking it's wrong to turn in a heroin pusher. You're not ratting. You're doing your part to wipe out one of the most insidious epidemics racking our country today. So don't let anyone kid you. If you really care about the quality of life, if you really care about improving society, you'll do everything you can to get the heroin pusher off the street and into jail where he belongs. If you have information about a drug pusher, use the heroin hotline. The number is 800-368-5363. That's toll-free from anywhere in the country. The number again is 800-368-5363. A trained operator will answer your call, take your information, and pass it on to experienced federal agents who will investigate. You'll make your own special contribution toward helping us wipe out what President Nixon has called public enemy number one. Call 800-368-5363.
And now here is CBS News correspondent George Herman.
Let me return to the use of the present tense in your statement to Senator Weicker. Do you consider that you are still, in effect, serving the president?
Well, I think that when I left the White House, I had hoped that I'd be able to return to private life. I'd had 3.5 very grueling years in the White House. I must say I did not anticipate what has followed my return to private life. It hasn't been as private as I hoped it would be. And I guess really, Mr. Herman, that I would have to say that it's part of one's continuing public service to respond to charges and, as a matter of fact, to try to tell the truth to the American people about what happened during the last 4 years in the Nixon administration. Those of us who have been in the White House, I guess, don't have the luxury of being quite as private as we would like.
You are, in a way, still serving the president.
I would suppose that by trying to tell the truth to the American people about what I know happened during the years that are now so controversial, that that's part of one's continuing obligation to the public, yes.
Mr. Colson, as the president's appointed defender or self-appointed defender, can you explain why, after you, by your own statement, warned the president that there were people in his administration involved in the Watergate, in early January, he said nothing about it for months?
Well, first of all, to be factually correct, it was late January. I did not warn the president that people in the administration were involved. I warned him that I thought people higher up in the campaign organization were involved. The president told me then, as he told me in mid-February, as he told me in mid-March, that he wanted very much to get to the truth. He wanted to get the facts. He had no hard evidence. I had no hard evidence. We had suspicions, we had doubts, we had concerns, but that's a very different thing. You know, as Mr. Glanzer I saw on television last night, one of the Watergate prosecutors who's just resigned, said that in a conspiracy of this kind, it is terribly difficult until someone talks to get to the heart of it. It was as hard for the president to get the truth and the facts, and he wanted to act judiciously, and I think that's admirable, as it was for the prosecutors, as it was for someone like myself who was trying to find out what was going on. In what now appears to have been a rather tightly held conspiracy, that's a very difficult thing to do. The president, in every conversation I ever had with him, and that goes back to June 19th regarding the Watergate, wanted very badly to find out what was happening, to get to the truth. It was a very hard thing to do. I think when he got to the truth, he acted as quickly and as prudently as any man could.
Mr. Colson, this is a folder full of things that impute things to you and your denials of them, but you're not a defendant here today, and I'm not a prosecutor here today. I'm a journalist and trying to get a little bit closer to the truth than we are. Since last August, it appears, you've been trying to get some independent idea of what happened. There was apparently a memo that you wrote August 29th, which it is said that John Dean destroyed and didn't want to give to the president on the day when he was having a news conference. You've been in touch with him and in touch with others. What is your theory of what went wrong?
Well, that would take longer than we have here, Mr. Shore, to give you a fully responsive answer to that. It is perfectly clear now, in hindsight, that people did not tell the president the truth, people who knew the facts. Now, I think at the very center of that conspiracy to keep the truth away from the president was John Dean. And what absolutely appalls me is to see that man stand before the American people, as he did this week, on all three networks, and say that he hopes the American people will forgive the President of the United States. Forgive the President of the United States for his John Dean sin, refusal to tell the President the facts.
Let me take this a step further. You have said in an interview that the tragedy of Watergate is that the President was misled by his closest advisors. His closest advisors were H.R. Haldeman and John Ehrlichman. Do you believe they had a part?
Well, I'm not going to try to characterize the roles of anyone in this until they've had their day in court. I think that Bob Haldeman and John Ehrlichman will be coming before the Irvin Committee and will be laying out their own facts as they saw it, their own story. And I think they're entitled to do that. And I'm not going to characterize in advance whether they told the president everything that they could or not, because I don't know that.
But how did it go wrong? I mean, you surely are not going to say, maybe you will, that John Dean had masterminded a plot all by himself.
I think he was at the center of this.
Can we stand back and look? There has to be a hypothesis of how it happened, if the president was misled, how he was misled, what led up to it, what did it?
Well, first of all, the president, I believe to this day, has never been told who it was who ordered or authorized the Watergate. All of the principal figures continue to deny the fact that they themselves ordered or authorized the Watergate. Now, it's a very difficult thing to be talking about cover-up until you know what it is you're trying to cover up. The president, in every conversation I had with him, including March 21st, the night that John Dean allegedly laid all of this story out to the president, the president was constantly trying to find out who was behind the Watergate. And it's very difficult. In hindsight, it's obvious that a lot of people were protecting themselves. And I think when all of the evidence is in, that that will become clear. And I think it will become clear that the president was absolutely innocent.
But who was behind it? I mean, you're giving the negative of what did not happen. What,
Mr. Shore, I really don't know.
Don't you have a hypothesis of your own?
I really don't know who ordered or authorized the Watergate. I've watched the evidence unfold. There's certainly a great deal of circumstantial evidence that points a finger at people in the Committee for the Re-election of the President.
John Mitchell
and Jeb Magruder. But as I say, circumstantial evidence. I think Magruder's case perhaps a little more than that.
You said that you told the President in late January that John Mitchell would have to step forward. Is that not in your deposition?
No. I think what I said specifically with regard to John Mitchell was in February 14th, just before I was leaving for a trip abroad. I told the president that I was convinced, based on circumstantial evidence and based on hearsay reports, that higher-ups in the committee, and most probably John Mitchell, had been involved. And if that were the case, that this fact had to come out, and the sooner it would come out, the better. The president reacted to that particular statement on my part in a very admirable way. What he said is, John Mitchell has denied that he has any involvement. He's denied that under oath. And I'm not going to take an innocent man, or a man who may be innocent, and make him a scapegoat, even though I want to get to the bottom of the Watergate. I don't want this issue hanging over my head.
But did he then start an investigation of your charges about Mr. Mitchell?
I didn't make any charges about Mr. Mitchell. I said to the president that it seemed evident to me, from the information that I was beginning to get, that someone higher up had to be involved. I used to be in the Marine Corps, and if something goes wrong in the company that you're in, the company commander has got to take the gaff, to take the heat.
Mr. Carlson, in light of what you said about the president not being involved in the cover-up, I'd like to ask you to explain a couple of things. First one is this. After all that had been said to him by Mr. Dean, How could he on March 26th give a public clean bill of health to Mr. Dean?
Yeah. Well, you're assuming that Mr. Dean said the things that he said to the president. Mr. Dean's testimony this week is a far cry from the information that I am personally familiar with respect to Mr. Dean's state of mind at on the 21st
of March. You're calling Mr. Dean a liar?
Let me explain that to you. I don't think I have to. I think that Mr. Dean's own testimony has impeached the real thrust of the charges that he made. After all, stop and go back now through that 248 pages of carefully constructed testimony. Elaborate detail. 5 days of nationally televised 3 networks coverage of his testimony. Really, what it all boils down to is that on March 21st, he said to the president, there's a cancer on your presidency, and you've got to take some steps to remove it. But then Mr. Dean went up to Camp David and was asked to write a report, which might be for public consumption or might be for internal consumption. It's exhibit number 39. I think it's one of the most extraordinary documents I've ever seen, because in it, repeatedly, Mr. Dean continues to perpetuate the lies. He continues to hold information back from the president.
Mr. Colson,
this is after he was supposed to have told the president everything.
Just to go back to my original
was involved in the Watergate
question, if we could. Could you explain why the president on March 26th, in light of this, in light of his conversation with March 21st, felt he had to give a public clean bill of health to Mr. Dean?
I think I can surmise why.
Why?
There would be two reasons. One, I don't believe that Mr. Dean laid out all the facts as he says he laid them out to the president on March 21st. And I know that because of what the president said to me when he called me on the evening of March 21st and said to me that he had to get to the bottom of the Watergate himself. He had to find out the truth. He had to find out what was going on. He knew at that point that he was not being told the truth, that he was being given confusing information. He didn't know who to believe or who to rely upon among his principal advisors at that point in time. I had left the White House there. And during this conversation, I made a recommendation to the president, which I'd like to come to in a minute. But I think that's one reason. I don't think the president knew at that point in time who to believe and who not to believe. I think he had been given a lot of very confusing and misleading stories by people who were trying to protect themselves, to be perfectly honest about it. Secondly, I think the president, which I know he did, began his own investigation. You wouldn't tip your hand. You wouldn't indicate who you thought was responsible at that point in time until you'd been able to investigate.
Well, that goes to my second point, Mr. Colson. On April 30th, President Nixon is supposed to have named Mr. Ehrlichman to run the investigation of the Watergate after Mr. Ehrlichman had been implicated. Now, why didn't President Nixon go to the prosecutors with what information he had instead of naming a principal in the case to carry out the investigation?
Well, I think your date is off. The April 30th was the date that the president...
It was March 30th.
March 30th.
March
30th. I beg your pardon. March 30th.
I don't believe that there was any evidence that I'm aware of, at least, that would implicate Mr. Ehrlichman at that point in time. I think that the president was trying very hard from everyone to get whatever information he could.
Don't believe, Mr. Dean, that he had implicated Mr. Ehrlichman to the president by then?
No, and I think that the president was asking Mr. Ehrlichman, he was asking Mr. Haldeman, he was asking Mr. Dean, he was asking me to come forward to him directly and to give to him whatever evidence could be determined directly to him as to who was involved in the Watergate. Once again, Mr. Novak, who was involved in the original ordering of the Watergate? That was still not known at that point in time. I'm not sure that it's fully known now.
Mr. Colson,
understood,
ma'am. I'm afraid we're getting into too many specifics, and I'd like to get to a more general question. In fact, the White House summary of these things provided to the Senate committee indicates that Dean at one point mentioned the possibility that Mr. Ehrlichman may have been involved in the cover. Let's get away from that. Knowledgeable people construct a hypothesis about the cover-up which goes like this, and I'm not talking now about the Watergate conspiracy, but about the cover-up, that there are two basic elements involved in a cover-up which was much more pervasive, involved many more people than the Watergate conspiracy itself. And that was, first, at least until November 7th, that anything which could cast a shadow on the re-election of the president had to be avoided. Secondly, the fear that if the Watergate conspiracy were to be revealed, considering that Gordon Liddy and Howard Hunt were involved, that might then open up other incidents such as the break-in into the office of Dr. Ellsberg's psychiatrist, the Tom Houston surveillance plan, so that many people became involved and implicated in the cover-up who had not been at all involved in the Watergate conspiracy, and that these were the two main motives for a quite massive cover-up. Would you comment on that hypothesis?
Well, taking the first point, the election campaign, I think it's quite true that during the election, first of all, I had no indication at all, and I don't think, I know the president did not, that anyone in the White House had been involved in any of the pre-June 17th events. So that what you were really talking about, it appeared to me, it appeared to the president, I know from what he told me, that if higher-ups in the committee were involved, they would come out in the course of investigation. It was a number one campaign issue, and I think it's understandable that all of us in the White House were very happy not to have it on the front pages every night, not to have it leading the network news each night. That's a human reaction in a political campaign when you're viewing something largely as a misguided action by the campaign committee. No one, I know the president did not know at that point in time how widely this apparently had extended by virtue of what we now know from subsequent testimony. As to the fear that other things would be revealed if everything was made clear, I just don't think that's a valid point at all, for this reason, that if you look at Mr. Dean's testimony, he says that in the middle of November, Mr. Haldeman called him in and said the president wants to lay out all the facts about Watergate. And the president had said that to me on a number of occasions. We've got to get the truth out, and we don't want this hanging over the second term. That was the state of the president's mind. Now, what did Mr. Dean say to Mr. Haldeman? He said, if you do that, the likelihood is that Dean, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Mitchell, Magruder, and Strachan will all be indicted.
Now, with a question mark next to your name.
No.
In one list that
no.
Mr. Dean drew up.
Well, that was the list that Mr. Dean drew up in the end of April of 1973, and he put 20-odd names on that list. And that was very cleverly done in the hopes that there'd be so many names that people would still be afraid to...
No, I didn't mean to distract you from the main point.
But it's a very important point. At no time ever in any of these lists that Mr. Dean drew up did my name appear until April 30th of this year, after I had recommended to the president on two separate occasions that Mr. Dean be removed, which Mr. Dean knew. But I'm just going back to the basic point that the president's attitude, and I... You know, what is really the central issue to the American people today? The president has been accused, very, very serious accusations by John Dean this week. I say those accusations are unfounded and untrue. And I think that as the evidence comes in, and there is much more to come in, now we've heard from the accuser.
No, but you're hearing from the... I never mentioned the president, Mr. Colson. I'm really not trying to prosecute anybody. I'm trying to get us...
No, but I think that's the central question.
If you can help us to understand the motives behind the cover-up. You say it is not true that there was a fear of getting back to other illegal acts.
If there was, I'm not aware of it. My reading of this, and I think this point has to be made, Mr. Schur. Mr. Dean has talked about some 30 or 40-odd meetings which took place at which the cover-up was discussed. I wasn't present, according to his account, and I wasn't, in fact, present at any of those meetings. So it's very hard for me to penetrate the motives of the people who were present at those meetings. I wasn't there.
Mr. Colson, the president
didn't know about those meetings. But let me just say this.
Okay.
It is very clear to me, from the one account that I gave you, that the president wanted the facts laid out about the Watergate. But when the man who was charged with responsibility for getting those facts, the man who conducted the investigation, says to all of his colleagues, we're all going to be indicted if we lay out the truth. Well, that is the incentive not to lay out the truth on the part of those who serve the president. And that's why I say that the truth never was given to the president. He wanted to lay the facts out. Mr. Dean used many tactics to prevent people from stepping forward and telling what the truth was.
The president and Mr. Dean are not the only people accused here. Your name has come up in connection with the possible burglary of the Brookings Institution. What, if anything, did you tell John Caulfield? What will he testify to that you told him about the Brookings Institution and getting some papers out of it?
I have no idea what Mr. Caulfield will testify to. I know what the truth is, and I've given it to the federal prosecutors. There was a great concern in the middle of 1971 over security leaks, the Pentagon Papers. What additional documents...
I hope you're not going to give us a John Dean answer. I just want to really know what you told Mr. Caulfield.
simply that he should be in touch with the appropriate federal investigative agencies to determine whether there were security violations on the part of several organizations, Brookings being one. I never suggested that he take any illegal or improper...
You did not ask him to have Mr. Ulasewicz case the place?
I never heard of Mr. Ulasewicz until I read about him.
Or to have Mr. Caulfield case it through any of his aides?
No, I did not.
You
did not ask to have any papers taken out of it?
No.
Mr. Dean's testimony also mentions your conversation with Mr. Hunt about executive clemency and or whatever else you want to call it. And he mentions the fact that Mr. Ehrlichman asked you not to talk to the president, and you did talk to the president about it. Are you denying all of that as a fairy tale?
Well, let me say this. I would commend to your reading, Mr. Novak. Have you gentlemen read Exhibit Number 39? That
some of us have.
Some? Yes. It's a very revealing...
The handwriting, but...
Well, it's difficult to read, but it's a very revealing document. In here, Mr. Dean does not allege that Mr. Ehrlichman... This is the recounting of what happened.
Well, I'm not so much interested, Mr. Coulson, what Mr. Dean said. I'm just asking you whether you did have...
Well, you are interested in what Mr. Dean said because you're predicating your question on what Mr.
Dean
said.
Did you talk to Mr.
Ehrlichman
about it?
I never discussed executive clemency with the president. I never discussed executive clemency with Mr. Hunt. I never discussed executive clemency with Mr. Bittman. Now, let me just say to you that the report which John Dean wrote in Camp David in his own handwriting the weekend after he was supposed to have told the president everything, the whole truth, had all these conversations with the president, alluded to the fact that I had discussed executive clemency with the president. In his own report, he does not make any reference to that whatsoever, and furthermore says that I refused to give any kind of an assurance to anyone. He knew, when he wrote this report, he wasn't trying to seek immunity as he was this week during the Senate hearings. He wasn't trying to create public pressure. There are parts of this report that I suspect he wrote and are quite true. Other parts I would question.
Getting back to you and Mr. Hunt, you have said before that there was a discussion between you and Hunt over commitments that had been made to Hunt. What commitments are you talking about? Money? Clemency?
I haven't the slightest idea.
You mentioned commitments.
No. The conversation that you're referring to, Mr. Hunt called me in mid-November of 1972. I recorded the phone conversation. During that conversation, he said that commitments had been made to him. He was not specific.
You didn't ask him?
I did not ask him. The recording of that phone conversation, I immediately turned over to Mr. Dean, and I said to Mr. Dean at that time, you'd better get into this and find out what's going on. This doesn't sound right to me. What did Mr. Dean do? He took that same tape and played it for other people, Mr. Haldeman, Mr. Ehrlichman, and Mr. Mitchell, according to his testimony. I don't know if it's so or not. And I couldn't get that tape back from him. And when I first began to suspect that Mr. Dean may have had more to do with the Watergate than he had professed, I tried to get that tape back. It took me 3 weeks
Mr.
to do
Coulson,
it.
Your answer
and
to...
I turned it over to the prosecutor.
Your answer to every question is an attack on Dean.
Let me ask you one question about something that you have admitted.
Well, let him answer. Sorry, it's Novak's question.
Is that a strategy?
That's a fair question. No, we have had 5 days, almost 8 hours a day, of Mr. Dean pouring forth his tale to the American people. The bottom line of it all is that he accuses the President of the United States of involvement in the Watergate and the Watergate cover-up.
And Charles Coulson.
Well, he tangentially refers to Charles Coulson. What happens to Charles Coulson? My point is that what happens to Charles Coulson or Bob Haldeman or John Ehrlichman or any of the others of us who serve the President, John Mitchell, is really very secondary. There is a fundamental question that is before the American people, and that is, was the President involved or wasn't he? The sole accusation against the president is made by Mr. Dean, and I say that Mr. Dean's testimony will not stand cross-examination, certainly on the basis of his own report at Camp David, and I say that his testimony does not implicate the President of the United States. That, to me, is question number one before the American people. We can take years determining the reforms that are needed in the political process, and there are reforms needed. We can take years determining who was responsible for what, but I think it's imperative that the American people know immediately the truth about the President of the United States. He was not involved.
About a more current matter, not directly related to Watergate, the indefatigable Seymour Hersh of the New York Times has a story this morning detailing efforts by you involving efforts before the National Labor Relations Board to change a case there, a court case in Pennsylvania, and the effort to get out of office a black who had a job in New York. True?
No. And you can't answer that question true or false. That story it really reflects to me the sort of poisoned waters that exist in this city today. You can plant any story you want about anyone. I knew a month ago, Mr. Schurer, when I made the very conscious decision. I hadn't been very much in the press with respect to Watergate. There hadn't been many accusations about me. Go back and look at the press clips in the month of May, and you'll see that very little was said. But I reached a point in early June where I could no longer sit idly by while people were manufacturing stories, innuendo, third-hand hearsay, opinions by Mr. McCourt implicating the President of the United States in the Watergate. I came forward and told everything I knew publicly, and I am going to continue to do so. Now, I knew the moment that I did that...
What does it have that to
I
do
was,
with...
Well, I knew the moment I was going to do that that I would be the butt of a lot of stories like the one in the New York Times this morning. I knew
true.
There would be a very conscious effort to discredit me. No, the story in the Times this morning is not true. The story in the Times this morning, I know the source of that story. It's a disgruntled former official of the Labor Department who wanted to be Secretary of Labor and who knows very well that I recommend
Larry Silverman a liar?
Well, there's no direct statement that is in that story this morning that would make Mr. Silverman a liar, no. But the implication, the innuendo, the twist to the story, I've gotten very accustomed to this.
I mean, you don't like the way the story is put, but you're not denying it.
Oh, I'm denying the story. I never heard of it. I don't even know what the case in Pennsylvania is.
Mr. Cole, you do know
I
about
did oppose the appointment of Mr. Cottrell in New York because he was opposed by all of the unions that he would have to regulate. He was opposed by Governor Rockefeller. He was opposed by John Mitchell. Those are good reasons. And there was a better candidate, in my judgment.
You didn't help the Teamsters before the Labor Relations Board?
No, I never had any contact with the Labor Relations Board at all. I referred the Teamsters to the Labor Department when they had a problem in that particular case.
When you started to go public on June 10th with an interview in the New York Times, you said, when they lower me away 6 feet under, I will go under as a Nixon loyalist. In view of that, why should we pay any attention or give any credibility to your defense of the president? Even if he were guilty, you would defend him, wouldn't he?
Well, the answer to that is no. If my defense of the president is based upon my deep belief in him as a man, and I have known him since 1956, my deep belief in the great works of his presidency, I don't believe that impeaches my credibility. My word is going to stand, and the word of others, against Mr. Dean, the president's principal accuser. Mr. Dean is seeking immunity. Mr. Dean is seeking to put public pressure on the prosecutors not to prosecute him. Now, I'll stake my credibility, if you say it's impugned by my loyalty to the president, I'll stake my credibility against Mr. Dean's any day of the week. I've known this man, the president, since 1956. I know his integrity. I know his determination, his courage to do what is right for this country. And I'll stand for what I know to be the truth against Mr. Dean's accusation.
On that stand, I have to interrupt you. Thank you very much for being with us today on Face the Nation. We'll have a word about next week's game in a moment.
Thank you.
Young I may be, but still I'm a man. Turn 18 and I'll do what I can. Find me a place where I can be me. Get ready for life, be free and free. Oh, where do I go from here? Oh, where do I go from here? I'm finished with school, but what lies ahead? Don't wanna get trapped, wanna feel free instead. All over the world, there's so much to do. The call of the sea, don't you hear it too? Where do I go from here? Where do I go from here?
What about the new Navy? You'll get your chance of success, learn an exciting job, and see the world. Call toll-free 800-841-8000 or see your Navy recruiter. Be someone special in the new Navy.
I know where I'm going from here.
Today on Face the Nation, Charles Colson, former special counsel to the president, was interviewed by CBS News correspondent Daniel Shore, Robert Novak, syndicated columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times, and CBS News correspondent George Herman. Next week, the original prosecutors of the Watergate case, who have now withdrawn from the continuing investigation, will face the nation. Today's broadcast was recorded earlier today in Washington and was produced by Sylvia Westerman and Prentice Childs. Robert Vitarelli was the director. Face the Nation is a production of CBS News. This is the CBS Radio Network.